Mini episode 1733 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode 1732. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris coming at you, and we have today here our NBA Finals review for the year 2024, and this marks the 10th time that I have done a Finals review as well as a Finals preview with FDH Hoops analyst Ben Chu, one of our favorite FDH Lounge dignitaries, and along the way, I am what you would call an impressive 7-3 over a period of time, but nobody would ever take note of anything like that because it is up against what is now a 10-0 mark. Ben Chu calling them perfectly since the 2015 NBA Finals. He and I both got the Cleveland Golden State Finals correct the 4 years that they happened. The first time that I was wrong and he was right was 2019 when I, along with the rest of the world, went with the chalk of Golden State. He went with Toronto and was right on that one. We split in 2021. I had Phoenix, he had Milwaukee. And then this year, the reverse image of 2019 when he had Toronto as the big underdog. I had Dallas, he had Boston. And again, as much as I loathe all things Boston, at least I get to take a little bit of comfort here from the notion. Ben Chu, 10-0. It all happened on this show. It's demonstrable. You can go back. You can play it back. It's all in the archives. It's right here. 10-0 and no end in sight is what I would say. Congratulations, Ben. Great to have you down here for the recap.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it. I'm coming for you, Harry Connick Jr. I'm coming.
Yeah. You should be. You absolutely should be. 10-0.
It was the three against the rules. Wasn't it 16 in a row?
Yeah, I think so. And again, no reason that you can't keep this thing going further on. And it's one of these things where, again, I looked at it, and clearly I oversimplified when I looked at Luka being the best player in the series here. So I have to be accountable on that I certainly overrated what that was going to be. And I thought that Kyrie was playing at a strong enough level that he'd be able to support him here throughout. But as I'm listening to the great podcast out of Dallas, The Dumb Zone, and they're talking about that, and they spend a lot of time talking about Dallas sports as well as other things in the world. But it sounded reminiscent of listening to Cavs talk when they were playing the Warriors back when the Cavs had nobody healthy aside from LeBron that was really that good in 2015, and then 2017, 2018, when Kevin Durant got there and stacked the deck. It was one of those things where, you know, should we do this? Should we do that? Like, you get into a lot of these discussions, and it's like, just the fact that you're having the discussions, basically, it's great for talk radio, right? Because they're great points of debate. I remember the one game after Mozgov had the big game in the finals in 2015, what was it, like 28-10 or something like that. But then, like, he got benched in the next game for a good chunk of it because the Warriors went to the death lineup and they played him off the floor because he wasn't able to cover Draymond Green. And it was the whole thing. The biggest debate of the 2010s, Ben Chu, wasn't what color is the dress. It was should Mozgov have been playing or should he not have been playing. And I'm looking at it like, I mean, I think maybe they probably should have put him out there because they weren't getting offense from anybody other than LeBron, but you're going to lose either way. I mean, you're going to lose because of his defense, even if he puts up 30 or 40. So I'm listening to these guys, and they're talking about where's the third option coming from and everything like that, and I'm thinking to myself, man, did I get hornswoggled because I looked at this Dallas team coming out of the West, and I never questioned who's the third option. And it's one of those things where if you can't answer that question definitively coming into the finals, it should be very hard to pick them. And that's one of the big areas I went wrong with Dallas because PJ Washington is not going to be that. on a night in, night out basis. And you look at some of the other players here, you know, involved, and you're just not going to be able to get on a consistent enough level. Derek Lively, he gives you, you know, good putback offense, at least at this point, but I mean, he's not going to be more than that. And, you know, whether it be, you know, you're going to try and get something out of Derek Jones Jr. or whatever, when you're basically down to trying to look for the hero of the night as your third option, you're not where you want to be. And like I said, those discussions, even going down to, are we desperate enough to try Tim Hardaway yet? Is it Tim Hardaway time? All those discussions they were having were bringing back memories in my own head, because you're never in a good place when you're asking these questions, because the answer is probably wrong either way.
Right, and I think overall one of the issues with this final series is, again, to give credit to Dallas, that they went to a relatively harder Western Conference, and Boston had a relatively easy road to the finals.
Yes.
But in totality, though, Rick, I feel like, and this is credit to Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, the Celtics team, and their coaching staff led by Joe Mazzulla, is that the big thing in this entire series was that they limited a lot of Dallas three-point attempts, because if you looked back in some of their earlier matchups during their one against Minnesota, like, Dallas is a very prevalent three-point shooting heavy team, but the Celtics defense was able to funnel them away. I think they, unless I'm mistaken, they had a plus 26 or 28 margin in total threes made against Dallas in this series. And in all honesty, Dallas kind of booted game two a little bit and booted game three after taking an early lead. So it's a little bit on them as well. But the argument would be is that Boston was just consistent the entire year, and it just kind of felt like watching the finals that it wasn't a foregone conclusion, but they were just so consistent that it just felt like Dallas was kind of shuffling for answers. And I always noticed this too. One thing that we'd always have to note is that during the regular season, even though, you know, Dallas went through a bunch of changes at the trade deadline, they did not play great games early on in the regular season against Boston.
Right. That's true. So the ability to match up there, definitely an issue. And then when you're getting into, again, we saw what difference a healthy Porzingis made in the finals. You insert him back in there for Boston. And this is one of these things, too, where the guys on the Dumb Zone were saying this, and I felt it was an excellent point. You're looking at Porzingis, Holiday, and White. When you have three guys from Boston where any one of those three would presently be your third best player on your roster when you put them in with Kyrie and Luka, that's not good, because, again, Tatum and Brown, there's a big drop down to those next three guys, but I don't think it's nearly as steep as the drop off between Luka, Kyrie, and whoever you slot right after them. Maybe Derek Lively, the rookie, who has yet to become a stretch five. Some are optimistic he could, but I mean, when you can make a solid argument that he's your third best player at this point, then once again, you're in trouble against a team like the Celtics.
Right, and I know, and we were both mentioning this on the finals previews, we were a little bit skeptical of Boston's bench, but they got solid contributions from Payne Pritchard and Sam Hauser, and got some good minutes from Xavier Tillman and Brissett as well. So they essentially just did what they needed to do. It really is that simple. I mean, in totality, it was kind of one of the more boring NBA finals we've had in recent memory. Not a single game was decided by 8 points or less. So
yeah,
that's all we need to know there.
That is definitely true. And when you look at the way that everything played out in the course of the series, yeah, you talked about that, the Dallas whizzed away a couple of early leads, and they did, and they just, again, couldn't sustain it. The way that Boston was defending them had a lot to do with it. They seemed to be just sort of going to the whole simplistic thing of make Luka beat us. And again, you know, it's amazing that that didn't work when anybody tried it in the Western Conference. And I was laughing about this with you off air, the entire simplistic notion that too many people have, that whenever you have a big man like Chet Holmgren who can shoot from outside, or at least pretty decently, the pundits a lot of times just assume, oh, it's a five-out team. Yeah, I've seen a couple of different pundits that have been like, how's come Dallas couldn't cope with Boston when they beat a five-out team in Oklahoma City? Like, I hate to tell you, but again, merely the fact that your center is pretty good at shooting the ball does not make you a five-out team. Josh Giddey exists, you know, which, by the way, you told me right before we started airing this here, as we date ourselves on when we're taping this, that he was just traded for Alex Caruso. But that's not going to make Oklahoma City a five-out team either. Dallas hadn't faced anybody like Boston coming into the finals, and it did show.
Right, and again, and we saw this, and again, I feel like too, especially when we do predictions in the league, especially for the finals prediction, is that sometimes there are times to listen to the numbers and listen to the data, and let's just be honest, Boston the entire regular season led pretty much every category in the top five. So this isn't really a shocking sort of manner. It's just, and also too, again, this is not disrespectful of the team or Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown or anyone on that roster. It's like they had a pretty easy road, and they had a finals opponent that they matched up relatively well against, and they just got it done. And you have to give credit to Joe Mazzulla, who was pretty much maligned for most of the season, including last year, for that sort of loss in the Eastern Conference Finals. So give credit to him. I felt he did a very good job with his game planning in games one and games three, too. So they did a really good job. But this is more, I think at the end of the day, Rick, the shine right now really should be focused on Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. Like, we're not far removed from discussions of, like, can they win together? And they did a very good job in the finals, especially, of playing off each other and all allowing opportunities to get assists. Like, I believe, unless I'm incorrect, that during that timeline, they had a 24-8 assist to turnover ratio combined. So
yeah,
they're just making good decisions. They essentially were the best team all year and were able to figure it out in the playoffs. And again, I do feel like they had a very favored matchup against Dallas, but I think we also have to be prisoner on the moments as well, that Dallas just didn't play that great. Luka was a little bit injured and Kyrie just kind of disappeared in this series. I don't think he scored more than 25 points in any game. I could be mistaken there though, but
yeah.
You know, Dallas was ahead of schedule, and this was Boston's best chance to win a title, so I'm not really surprised this is the outcome.
The one thing I want to say about the statistics, because you're right about what the numbers were telling us about Boston, I'm just going to point out to you that I don't think there's a whole lot of daylight between what the numbers were this year and what they were the previous year. Let us not forget that Boston looked better numbers-wise on the regular season, even better than Denver last year. So, you know, we've been here before with this Boston team, and they've been very, very high in the analytics numbers in the seasons previous to that. So, again, I think there was a certain amount of skepticism that was warranted as far as, okay, you know, you've been the best team on paper in the regular season the previous year, and perhaps more often than that, you haven't converted it into anything yet. And that's where, and I'm going to sit here now, even at the risk of sounding like a hater, and say, Denver went out because Minnesota was the most awful matchup they could have faced. But I still say if Denver had made it to the finals here, I don't think we'd be crowning Boston at this point.
And I think it's a very tough scenario, too, because I'm not 100% sure how good Denver was playing in the playoffs to begin with. They got through the Lakers, and they looked a little shaky against Minnesota at many periods of time. So it's tough to tell. And in all honesty, we truly do not know how great the Celtics team was. Like, on paper, they're one of the greatest teams of all time. But again, people will put the asterisks on them in terms of, like, who did they beat to get there? Essentially,
yeah,
a undermanned Miami team without their best player, an undermanned Cleveland team without their best player, and an undermanned Indiana team without their best player. So, again, at the end of the day, Boston deserves kudos for the way that they handled it, and they did a great job during this entire playoff run. But again, the question ultimately will be asked after a fact is, how good will the Celtics team be? And I think that's going to be indicative of how they do in upcoming playoffs.
Well, yeah. I mean, if they want to prove me, if they want to shut my mouth and everybody else's, do it again and do it in a way that's actually impressive next time. And they'll have the opportunity to do that next year. But as far as what we learned from this, from watching in the playoffs, to take a little bit of a wider view here, in terms of trying to extract any kind of lessons from this, I think that the team that is right squarely in the middle of the analysis would be Minnesota, because you look at, again, the way that they took out Phoenix in the first round, and I've said to you that I think, again, this is indicative of the death of the banana boat era once and for all. Because you look at what Phoenix did. Now, you can say with their stupid owner and the incompetently built way that they tried to do a super team, no real point guard, trading for Bradley Beal when he might be at least a little bit washed, et cetera, et cetera. You might look at it and say, well, this is the worst possible example of a banana boat team that you could possibly assemble, at least in the year 2024, and you might be right. But then Minnesota takes out Denver, and we were wondering about this as they were going along. Like, are we at the point now where a young team can actually do this, can actually convert, can actually break through, go all the way and do this? They get taken out by Dallas, and then Dallas, of course, gets taken out by Boston. And you look at the fact that, again, Dallas with Kyrie Irving in there, that was the key amount of experience that differentiated them from Minnesota. I know you've pointed out previously, and correctly so, that Minnesota had Mike Conley and a couple of other guys as well, but Conley is not presently one of the stars on Minnesota. And if we went further down the road, we could even get to ridiculous things like, well, Gordon Hayward was on Oklahoma City, albeit the fact that he really didn't see any daylight in the playoffs. But it's one of those things here where I feel like Minnesota proved that experience at this level isn't the end-all be-all that it used to be. But at the end of the day, the fact that they couldn't close it, and the fact that a Dallas team that was relatively young outside of Kyrie couldn't close it, I think it shows that it probably, experience matters a little bit more than it did in the prisoner of the moment thing where it looked like Minnesota might go all the way. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, I would lean towards that you're correct in the scenario. We've discussed this for years and years. It's very hard to win in the NBA playoffs.
Uh-huh.
And time again, we've seen it where analysts and NBA predictors get super excited about young teams when they get to the playoffs. And unless I'm mistaken, Rick, the only team that has even come really even close to doing that would have been the Spurs in 98 when they won with Duncan and Robinson. And that team was a little bit veteran-laden, but they still had a lot of young guys on that squad. So it's not, it is very, very rare in today's NBA, like starting from the 90s onwards,
yep,
to really win a title with a very young team. And I know everyone was high on OKC this year, and I still think they're a very good team heading into the next 2 to 3 years down the line. But we've just seen this time coming. It's hard to win in the playoffs, Rick.
Yes.
And like we saw with Tatum and Brown, like they took a long, they, Boston has won as many playoff games as any team since 2011, but they still needed to get over the hump at the end of the day. So again, it's different. The knees get heavier. Your shot profile gets different. You're playing against the same team 7 days over 10 to 14 nights. You know, it's a different experience than the regular season. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I felt like Boston, despite all of our preconceived notion, was still the best team. And they just, at the end of the day, had two of arguably, let's be honest, top 25 players in today's NBA.
Oh, no question about it. They did, and it certainly looked that way as they were going through. By the way, you did the very rare thing there of correcting yourself when you were right the first time. It was 99 with the Spurs, not 98.
Yeah, 99, but,
so that was good. But no, you raise an interesting point there because, again, you look at it, and I suppose to some degree the first year that Golden State broke through in 2015, because those guys had, you know, they'd gone in and gotten a cup of coffee in the playoffs here and there, but had not even been to a conference finals.
Yeah, unless I'm mistaken, Rick, there's only been 3 times in NBA history where a top 10 rookie draft pick has won a title.
Yeah. And
their first year, and I might be incorrect, but I believe it's Duncan, what was it, Duncan, Magic, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar when he was Lou Alcindor at that timeline.
Yeah, and when you...
I don't think any other guy has done it, so...
No.
I think in the NBA, we need to focus more on experience more than anything else.
Well, again, it's a very...
But then again, as we know, there are always going to be, you know, scenarios that bridge the gap. So, again, like, I'm just always more skeptical of super young teams in the playoffs, like OKC and Minnesota this year, but it would not shock you just the way that the NBA game is played these days that there will be a scenario down the line where a team with one or two really great young players and a deep bench can get to a finals and win.
Well, yeah, and the whole thing of, like, using a number one pick in the draft and winning a title with them. I mean, you look ahead in the years to come, and I think the odds are overwhelmingly good that that's going to happen with Wemby in San Antonio. But that being said, it's such a shockingly low record of converting on that with teams here. You've got, you look at the 2016 Cavs, Kyrie Irving did it as the number one pick overall, and then LeBron being the number one pick overall, but that one sort of doesn't count because he had left and come back. We're talking about when teams draft a number one pick, it's very rare for a number one pick to leave and then come back.
Unless I'm mistaken, Rick, I believe it's only 8 players in NBA history to have the overall number one pick and have won a title.
Yeah, and that's where, again, as we forget, and people talk about Jordan with Sam Bowie in the draft, but he wasn't going to be number one in that draft regardless because that was the Olajuwon year. So you think about it that, like, Magic did it, but obviously it couldn't be Magic and Bird because they were in the same draft class. Jordan wasn't number one overall, and it was very understandable at the time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That you oftentimes are getting the second pick in the draft, the third, the fourth, whatever, which to me I think just underscores the flukiness of it all, because nobody would sit here and say that your average 2, 3, or 4 pick historically has been better than your number one pick overall. I mean, at worst, it might be a pretty close call, but generally speaking, there is that great advantage to having the first pick in the draft. This year, as we covered in our previous show, would be the exception because Atlanta has got a couple guys to pick from that are still pretty raw, as far as ever living up to the status of being a number one pick overall. But, you know, that's one of the factors as we go forward in looking at this, is that, again, the standard way of building, and the whole thing that's behind really the entire system of tanking, the whole waiting for Godot kind of a thing of, like, you know, we're going to be really bad so we can get the number one pick or a real high pick and get a player like that. Yeah, the conversion rate on that is a lot lower than you would think. Even Brown and Tatum, they were high picks, but not the first pick. Luka, in retrospect, should have been the one pick that year, but wasn't. We could go on and on and on. So the amount of times that that actually happens is a lot lower than you would think. Anthony Edwards, that is somebody that could turn us around subsequently for Minnesota. I think he's going to be in a race basically with Wemby. And it's just a matter of whether Minnesota can convert and get over the hump before San Antonio is ready to get there.
Right. And it's going to be a very interesting scenario just in terms of how everything, and obviously we're dating ourselves with the timeline. J.J. Redick was just signed by the Lakers for a 4-year head coaching job. Yep. So it's going to be very, very interesting. Oh, also, too, Rick, I was just doing some quick numbers. I was mistaken. I believe it's 17 players all time.
Okay.
Who have won an NBA championship as the first overall pick.
But
the first one, I believe that is correct from this timeline, would be Elgin Baylor, Oscar Robertson, Elvin Hayes, Lou Alcindor, let me see, Bill Walton,
okay,
Magic Johnson, Mark McGwire, James Worthy, Hakeem, David Robinson, Shaq, Glenn Robinson, 112, Tim Duncan, LeBron, Dwight Howard, Andrew Bogut.
Okay.
Let me see, Kyrie, Anthony Davis, Andrew Wiggins. I think that's everyone. I may be forgetting one or two guys, if I remember properly. Like, I think Bob Lanier is also on the list of winning a ring at some point in his career as well. But
I think the point holds, though. Like, number one pick with their team.
Like, since 1947, only six, at least, if we want to give like a range, only 15 to 18 picks in NBA history who went overall number one have won a title. If you do, let me see, I could do the calculations.
Well, like half of them, Ben, maybe half of them.
So let's say 2002, 4 minus, was it 1947? That's 77 years, 77. So roughly, that's only 20 to 20, this is a fair analysis point, Rick. So it's roughly 25% of the first overall picks have won a championship in NBA history.
And that's the thing, though, but like probably less than half of them are with their same team, because you mentioned a bunch of names there. Big Dog, he won it as a role player on another team. Bogut, same. Howard, that was after he faded, same. So on and on and on here, and it was a thing where for Lanier, I don't think he was with his original team either, and I think he was more of a role player when it happened. So it's really one of those deals where it's a shockingly low conversion rate. But again, on paper, yeah. It's still the path that you're going to choose, whatever is the most sure. likely way to lead you to the title.
Other names that you can also include, too, is like, yeah, so it was 18, I forgot two guys. Cassie Russell was the overall number one pick in 1966. And also, Bob Boozer also won a ring.
Okay.
He was a 59 pick by the Cincinnati Royals.
Okay. So, yeah. You know.
So, yeah, roughly, Rick, you're talking about only that of all the number one picks in NBA history, which is about 77 to 80 years, roughly, if we include everyone within that timeline, that only 20, that below 25% of the first round picks only win a championship. And that's insane because you would think statistically that overall number one picks would have a higher percentage of championships eventually to their name.
You would think so. And I will tell you that if I'm an Atlanta Hawks fan and I hear this, I'm jamming an ice pick into my neck right now, because not only are you fighting between in your front office, who are we going to take, a bunch of guys that would never be number one in any other year for the most part. Now you find out that even if they become all that you want them to become, the odds are still somehow statistically against them leading you to a title. So it's
And I would make the argument too, of those 18 players, Rick, I'm only going to gander around 8 to 10 of them were like premier players.
Sure. And, you know,
on the team when they won a ring.
And as far as anybody to do it with their own team not having left and come back anytime recently, Kyrie kind of stands alone in that one here. The other names you're mentioning where it might have happened, they're all 20th century guys. So it's a real kind of low percentage kind of a thing. It is funny to think, as somebody who is a lifelong Cavs fan, that if anybody said to me in 2011 when Kyrie Irving was picked, coming off of the depression of the post-LeBron era here, that, you know, it didn't happen with LeBron, but the Cavs just used the number one pick on a guy who is going to win a world championship with this team, we would have had a hard time seeing it. But that's why, again, you never know what the future is going to hold. I will mention another point here, too, having just finished up an article. And, again, in the next week or so, you can check this out because we're not too far away from the NBA draft. Pro Hoops Draftology 2024, available on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com, as we break down the draft, but also the overall state of the NBA at this point, some other articles in there. And I had a real fun one on the back cover that I just finished up with, talking about, again, we've been saying this the last couple of years, that like the league has been in a slow transition period from that previous era to sort of like the next era. And I think we're basically about at the end of that, because the last couple of years, you'd still had, you know, Golden State came back in 2022. You still had, okay, well, Chris Paul's in the finals in 2021. There would still be these glimmers here and there from the previous era on this, but it does really kind of feel like we've turned the page. Again, Kyrie being a supporting act to Luka here. Ironically, he was a supporting act as a young guy to LeBron when the Cavs won it in 2016. But we're now at the point where, for the first time since 1974 to 1979, the league has had six different champions in 6 years. And this is one of the things we've been noting about this, too. And that I think from 2019 to 2021, that was the first stretch since 76 to 78 where we had six different teams in the finals. So we've been doing this a little bit the last couple of years, of where at that point it was kind of like some of the older players slash teams of sort of like the previous era versus you know, the teams and the players that were up and coming. But I think we're getting to sort of the end of this transitional period. So here's a question I want to pose to you. You look at the last six NBA champions, and there's a couple of these ones in here where it's ludicrous to even put them in the conversation. Toronto, the Lakers, Golden State, I would argue even Milwaukee right now with the number of questions that they have. But you look at Denver and Boston. If I was to give you the last six champions versus the field for next year, as far as where the winner comes out, what would you say? I would take the six teams because my early pick for the finals next year would be Denver and Boston. Would you take those six or the field, Ben Chu?
I'm just someone that will always take the field, Rick.
Okay.
In a case like that, because you never know what can happen.
Okay. Well, in as much as my Cleveland Cavaliers are in the field, I'm going to give you the line. So you're saying there's a chance.
There's always a chance, Rick, if I've learned anything in life.
Yeah. Well, I regret that we have not By the time that we have taped this, we have not yet gotten the Spida re-signing in the North Coast, but that appears to thankfully be just a matter of time. So we'll be watching all of that. The other developments here, as you said, J.J. Redick signing to be the coach of the Lakers there. And again, it's very much an open question on that one. I mean, you could do a what was he thinking or a what were they thinking on either side of the equation here. He's been in demand even beyond the Lakers a little bit, it seems. But again, he was always pictured for this job because of the podcast deal with LeBron. One wonders if that'll keep going, right? So a lot of different permutations to that thing. That pretty much locks it in for the Lakers to be able to keep LeBron. Although it would be funny if he peaced out on him at this point. He's been known to do that before. So the Lakers might not have to be as desperate as using a draft pick or their first round pick on Bronny.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. It's going to be a very interesting scenario with what the Lakers do and how Redick builds out his overall contract. But again, too, we still have a couple of other openings right now with Detroit and Cleveland, too, that still also need to be filled. So it's going to be interesting to see how both those teams do as well.
That's right. James Borrego getting linked to both, but stronger to Cleveland, it seems like, at this point. He seems to be the front runner, at least as far as how the media is framing it right now. We shall see. But coming off of the 2024 NBA Finals, Ben Chu, again, a Finals where you went 10-0, as you have done. You picked correct winner the last 10 years on this show. Any other thoughts on what we just saw?
No, I mean, it was a very sort of straightforward Finals, Rick. And congratulations to the Boston Celtics and their fans on winning the title.
On winning the title, as I sit here bitterly putting that in air quotes. But yes, they are technically listed as the champions in the record books, notwithstanding who they played along the way here. So, all credit to you, Ben Chu. It's the one thing I can live with out of this. Yes, Boston might have won a title, but you just went 10-0, our FDH Hoops analyst. So very proud of you for that. Congratulations again. Thank you, as always, for being here, bro. And thank you, as always, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1732.